I'm Gregory Hutchinson. I'm going to be the Regius Professor of Greek from October. So let me tell you a story about myself to start with. I was going to a conference or workshop, as they call it, in Manchester on the train. And I'd got a case with me containing lots of extremely valuable dog-eared Oxford classical texts, which you know burglars are very keen to take. So I'd got a combination lock on the suitcase. And I went to the combination lock to get a book out to read, and unfortunately I couldn't open it. I knew the combination lock, but the number wouldn't work. So I took incisive action. I phoned my wife. She suggested I got hold of the guardsman, who probably in his guardsman's van would have some tools that would be suitable for breaking open combination locks. But I thought this seemed a bit dramatic. So I thought, as there were only three numbers on the combination lock, there was a maximum of, well, there would only be 1,000 combinations, including 0, 0, 0. So I set to work trying all the possible combinations. And interestingly, you do each one and then yank, and didn't work, so tried again, yank. But interestingly, nobody on the train batted an eyelid at somebody obviously trying to get into a case which they didn't know the number. And eventually, I got to the right combination. It was the number I'd sort of programmed for it was 490, the Battle of Marathon, and it opened at 495. So perhaps if I'd fiddled about a bit more in the direction of the original one, that would have been better. Anyway, this rather sort of curious habit of mind, willing to fiddle around with numbers and so on, could be put to better uses, as I hope to illustrate in this talk. Our first thought is to consider the nature of prose and poetry, but from there we'll go on to think about how a bit of numerical analysis can contribute to considering some quite large issues of style and some issues of historical themes and so forth. Most languages, that I know of anyway, have a distinction between poetry and prose. Would anyone like to have a go at defining the difference between poetry and prose?
The end of the line of prose is dictated by the page and the typeface, whereas the poet is decided by his line.
Okay, so that's a matter of the way it's set out on the page. That's certainly true, and in many Greek poetry, eventually does that. And Latin. In inscriptions, they still quite often write continuously, mostly, in fact. Anglo-Saxon poetry, Old English poetry, is written just continuously. So that's not a universal difference, but it's certainly a common difference in presentation on the page. Thank you very much for that.
I read English. So.
You read English? Excellent. Any other thoughts, perhaps going beyond what's on the page?
Language which has a variable but noticeable pattern based on some factor such as stress accent or tone accent or alliteration.
Exactly, that's right. So poetry tends to follow some sort of pattern quite sort of rigidly. This isn't universally true, so as with all these things, we get into problems of definition once you get to modern vers libre and so on, free verse, but a sort of area we might be interested in exploring is the idea of there's a sort of fixed pattern. In Greek and Latin, the pattern is related to whether the syllables are long or short. But as those of you who did Greek or Latin remember, you've got this various meters in which you have fairly fixed patterns. In Greek, and Latin, it would never be unclear whether something was poetry or prose, but one might initially want to say, well, in poetry, there's a sort of, the rhythms are fixed, and in prose, they aren't. And that was often the way in which they talked about it. In Latin, you talk about oratio soluta, speech which is sort of loosed, free, it's not sort of bound in numbers, like sticks in a bundle. in this hand, on the first item in the handout, you'll see that an Italian 20th century writer said that she, in translating some Flaubert from French into Italian, she discovered that prose can be just as rigorous as poetry. That indeed, prose and poetry are the same thing, la stessa cosa. I've tried this heresy on some Italian friends, and they're satisfyingly shocked. I was once talking to an Italian in a person in a train. He was a very cultivated man. But I mentioned this idea, and he said, "Mamma mia." He was very, very shocked. But in there are various types of literature that combine poetry and prose. So in Sanskrit drama, for example, I don't know if you know some, if you're comparative, you should do some of that. But it alternates between prose and poetry. And people have been interested in writing prose poems, Hölderlin and others from the 18th century onwards. And as I was saying with T.S. Eliot and so on, some of his poetry is written in a rather free form of poetry, which is not very bound in its rhythm. So there can be variations. Particularly interesting, actually, as we're talking of Old English, is Alfrich, who writes prose, but sometimes sort of moves into a kind of prose poetry. So it's sort of following the alliterative rhythm and alliteration of Old English poetry. And interestingly, he does that at particularly heightened moments. So you've got this idea, which we'll pick up later on, of prose becoming particularly like poetry, particularly rhythmic, densely rhythmic, when it's an especially significant and powerful moment. So that's a thought to bear in mind. And if we were thinking further about the difference between prose and poetry, we might want to bring in something to do with emotional temperature, mightn't we? The sense that poetry is often more sort of emotional and engaged than prose. It's very sort of loose, rough generalizations, but they're just helping us to think about this phenomenon of the relation between prose and poetry. Anyway, as you probably know, Greek literature started off with poetry. Prose was a later invention, at least prose in the sense of works written on papyrus that would be circulated in prose. And it hadn't been going all that long before they started mucking about with it. And already in the sort of, let's say, early 4th century, you have people fiddling around with prose and experimenting with having more type of fixed rhythms in prose. Just as at the same sort of period, you have people fiddling around with poetry and making it less confined and limited. Instead of having neat stanzas that are all the same or come in recurring patterns, just free astrophic verse, which does have rhythms but is much less bound and limited. So you can see them experimenting from either end of this of the possibilities. The most influential and significant of these experimenters was somebody called Hegesias in the 3rd century, 3rd century BC, who was very interested in rhetoric and a teacher of rhetoric and an orator, and also wrote a history of Alexander. He gets a lot of bad press from later writers, but he was extremely influential. And he introduced a system, let's call it a system, just a sort of setup, in which most sentences in his prose and most phrases in those sentences had one of a specific group of rhythms. So it wasn't as tightly limited as poetry, but it's sort of moving a bit in that direction. He was very influential, and quite a lot of people imitated him in the Hellenistic period, that's to say from the 3rd century to the 1st century BC. His way of writing or the way he started, was taken up by Cicero. In my opinion, Cicero was the first significant writer to use this rhythmic style in Latin. After Cicero's death, this became a very popular way of writing, and it was taken up by most genres other than very technical writing or historiography. In historiography, the reason is probably that the writers want to seem stiff and archaic and Roman. What caused this shift to this rhythmic way of writing prose in Latin? Probably not entirely the influence of Cicero himself, as he didn't, in his lifetime, nobody else seemed to do this. It's more likely that it was the impact of Greek teachers of rhetoric, whose numbers increased in Rome at this period, sort of late years of Cicero and thereafter. In Latin, it's much easier to tell the difference between rhythmic prose and non-rhythmic prose. And you may be saying, well, what are these rhythms anyway? So let's have a look at item 3 on the handout, which gives you the beginning of his first speech against Catiline. Does anyone remember who Catiline was? Tell me about Catiline.
The Catalinian conspiracy was involved, yes. And Cicero, his speeches lead to death and execution.
That's right. Exactly. That's right, yes. So Catiline, according to Cicero, launches this conspiracy against Rome. Some historians think he was framed, but let's not get into that. Cicero is very keen to get Catiline to be explicit and, if possible, to leave the city, and so he could get rid of this conspiracy and have a deal with them with an army and so forth. But anyway, don't worry about all that. His first speech against Catiline is delivered with Catiline sitting on his own in the Senate. No one wants to sit next to him. Imagine that in school assembly or whatever. Cicero begins, usually Cicero's speeches begin saying sort of, if, which is not likely to be the case, such as being quite sort of in a quite relaxed way. But here he begins very urgently. I've got a translation under there in case you have any difficulty with that. Quos quetandem abutere Catilina patientia nostra. How long, Catiline, will you abuse our patience? And you can see there that every phrase, those very short phrases, has got one of these rhythmic endings. And now you can see these rhythmic endings under 4. The rhythmic endings are based around the idea of a cretic, long, short, long, dum-di-dum-dum. And you can have various combinations that are given there, dum-di-dum, dum-di-dum, or dum-di-dum-dum, that's like the usque tandem, or abutere Catilina. You can have 2 shorts instead of a long, so that's long, short, long, 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 the number 3. Patientia nostra, that's number 3 again. It's these specific rhythms that are characteristic of this style. If you look over the page, you can see that once you take account of all the possible combinations, there are other endings, only 2 other endings that you could have in a sentence, but they naturally occur very frequently, especially number 6, long, 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 long. And in Latin, this occurs particularly often. Does anyone know any reasons for that, why it might occur particularly? No, it's a bit difficult. But Latin is a bit sort of heavier than Greek. It's not got as many short syllables. So you end up, if you're not thinking about rhythm, your sentences very often end up with dum, 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 dum. So basically, if you've got prose that's got a very low proportion of 5 and 6, you can tell it's rhythmic. And if it's got a high or larger proportion, you can tell it's not rhythmic. You can also tell in Latin, because Latin's got a relatively predictable word order. What happens in Latin word order? Exactly, you tend to get the verb at the end. Whereas Greek, it's much less fixed. And you can often tell, especially from less skillful writers, when they're moving the words around in order to get one of these rhythms. So it becomes conspicuous what they're doing, like a poet who sort of rather creakily changes things around to get a rhyme at the end. Okay, so as I say, in Latin it's quite easy to tell rhythmic prose from non-rhythmic prose. And also, as I say, we can see historically what's happening very clearly. At least in my opinion, Cicero brings it in, and then after Cicero's death, practically everyone does it apart from writers of history and technical writers, writing on architecture and that sort of thing. In Greek, it's much harder to tell, and the historical development is much less clear, and much less scholarly work has been done on it. So this was a good opportunity for anyone who likes fiddling around with combination locks to do some counting. Some people think, and there's been very little sort of statistical work done on it, so there's not much basis for any opinions, but some people think that practically all prose in written in Greek in the imperial period, from this roughly 1st century AD onwards, is rhythmic. Other people have thought that none of it is rhythmic. Others have thought that some is. In other words, nobody has got a clue. Or not a very good idea. So we've got to start somewhere, and I started with the writer Appian. Did any of you read any Appian when you were at Oxford? Yes, might have been. Yes, because you might not have read him otherwise. Anyway, Appian wrote a history of the wars of the Romans. Nobody has thought that he might be rhythmic, except, I suppose, in theory, the people who think that all prose was rhythmic at the time. But nobody has really thought this. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is that people have looked for rhythmic prose, particularly in writers who are writing oratory or writing about oratory, which, as we'll discover, is not necessarily the right place to look. And also because people don't rate Appian highly. They used to despise Appian as a historian, just useless, inaccurate, muddled, and so on. Now they think of him as a much more careful historian. Historians have looked at him more closely. But everyone still thinks he's rubbish as a writer. But I don't think that. And I think that reading him carefully, you see he's a much more meticulous writer than you might have thought. And the way into this is to look at his rhythmic writing. So how does one discover whether his writing is rhythmic? Well, you can see under item 8 I've got a couple of quotes, or one quote at least, stylistically undistinguished, but far from unreadable. I wouldn't be very pleased to have that in a review. Largely colourless and artless. I don't think of him like that at all. Anyway, with the bit of his work that's preserved complete, he wrote this long work on the wars of the Romans, but the bit that's preserved complete is the bit about the civil wars of the Romans, 5 books of this, 645 pages in the Teubner edition. So I've scanned all these metrically. You can't, unfortunately, do it on a computer, or that's what the computers people say. I don't altogether believe them, but I think it'd be a lot of hard work for them. So they say they can't do it. Anyway, if you do it with a pencil or a pen, you get more idea of what's going on. And if you do this, you find, under item 10, that, as you can see from the figures in brackets, over 85% of his sentences end rhythmically in these various books. If you compare that with Lysias, do you remember when Lysias is writing? It's the 4th century BC, so he's before Hegesias, not a rhythmic writer. You see it comes out as 59.7 sentences end rhythmically. I go for the ends of sentences because there it's clear where you've got a unit that ends. The phrases are also arranged rhythmically, and I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment, but it's statistically most satisfactory to go for something where it's definite that it's a sentence ending. So there's a pretty big difference there. If we compare it with Cicero, who certainly writes rhythmically, Under item 12, you can see just a few small bits of him. 88%. Hello, have a handout. Not at all. Lovely to see you. You can see he has 88% rhythmic in one little extract. 93% in another. But it's clear that Appian is closer to Cicero than he is to Lysias. So this makes it likely that he's rhythmic. But you might say, well, it makes it likely, but what sort of likelihood is involved? Could it just be accident? Well, probably some of you know more than I do about the statistics of this, but there are various types of chi-squared tests that you can apply to see whether you've got the same kind of distribution in two sets of data. What I mean by that is particularly, supposing they're all random. Nobody thinks about it. Supposing you've got an author who's not bothered how his sentences end, so it's just a sort of happens randomly. How does that compare with somebody who is arranging his sentences deliberately? If we've got these two samples, Appian and Lysias, you could do a chi-squared test to see how likely it is that they're both random, or at least that they both belong to the same type of distribution, to put it a little bit more technically. And if you do a sort of chi-squared test of a particular kind, this is under 13, I won't go into all the mathematical detail, it would be just too exciting. The probability that they are both random and the difference between them is just accidental is absolutely minute. Because chi-squared is 144.33. The larger the chi-squared figure, the smaller the probability. So if it were 15.14, you can see it would be 1 in 10,000. It just goes way beyond the usual tables and online calculators and so on. So in effect, we can say that there's a zero possibility that the difference between Appian and Lysias is due to chance. There is a little problem, though. The sentences we've been looking at are more usually consecutive. And so, in theory, they might influence each other. And it's vital for this sort of chi-squared test that the samples are all independent. So although the answer we've got is so spectacular that it's probably right, we want to do some confirmatory tests. And so one of these tests you can do is to take 400 sentences at random, so open a page, put your finger on, note what the ending is. If you take 400 from Appian's BC, i.e. his Civil Wars, and 400 sentences, 20 from each of 20 authors writing before this rhythmic system came in, so non-rhythmic, certainly non-rhythmic authors, you can see that with under 14 here, with Appian we get 82%, with the pre-rhythmic authors we get 62%, pretty similar to the kind of difference there was between the Appian and the Lysias. Because we've got a smaller sample here, the chi-square is not so spectacularly large, but it's 38.8%, so again, we can say it's fairly certain that Appian is not random, and so Appian is following a rhythmic system. He's a rhythmic writer. If we go more deeply into the sentence, not just looking at the end of sentences, we'll notice phrases in Appian end rhythmically as well, for the most part. The rhythms tend to become even more frequent when he's emphasising something, when it's important, his themes, when he's building up the emotional temperature. I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute. But just look at item 16, which I will read to you in Greek. The pronunciation is sort of rather old-fashioned from Appian's point of view, but it'll be more easily recognisable for you, so I'll try and follow that. And try and listen for these dum-di-dum-dum, or dum-di-dum sort of rhythms. Epitas polis osulas meteie, kai ekolas de kai tas de. Ton men acropolis kata skapton. E teke katairon. E koinas zdemias epitites. E esporais ek trukon barutatais. So it's got this lilting sort of, from our point of view, this lilting kind of rhythm to it, but doing all these horrible things that the nasty person Sulla is doing. I don't know if you remember Sulla from Roman history, he's a pretty bad sort. At the end of Sulla's Plutarch's Life of Sulla, he explains he was a nice chap, really. Similarly, in item 17, talking about his infamous proscriptions, where he had this idea of, he was very thorough about punishing people, and then he put up a list to say whom he was going to punish. Houtos gardoke protos, hus ekolase tanatoi prograpsai, kai gera tois anairusi, kai menutra tois elenkusi, kai kolases tois cryptus in epigrapsai. Do you can notice there, there's a neat link between prograpsai, prescribe, and epigrapsai, writing up punishments, proscribe and prescribe. So it's very ornate, elaborate kind of writing, not the sort of careless type of style that people have too hastily assumed. Now, let's stand back a moment and think about Greek historiography. The Romans were not interested in writing about Greek history, with the exception of Alexander the Great. The Greeks in the imperial period were very interested in writing about Roman history, and really, most of our major sources are Greek historians, obviously not Tacitus and Livy. But they follow different approaches to the structures that they conceive of for writing about Roman history. So Cassius Dio, or Dio Cassius, writes a long chronological sequence. And into that, his history of the late Republic, which is the where the Appian civil wars come, that's where it fits. It's part of this long chronological sequence. Appian has got a different scheme. He tells about wars essentially in different areas. So it's kind of combination of time and space. Within a given area, it works chronologically, but it's arranged differently from just a straight chronological telling of the story. Plutarch has got a different idea again. Plutarch breaks things up into people. So he has all these matching biographies of Greeks and Romans, and we get the story of the late Republic, in particular, told through lots of different angles. You see how it looked to Pompey, how it looked to Caesar. So it's a very interesting way of presenting the story. And you can think of sort of modern novels in which you have this kind of thing where you deliberately sort of break things up and have one person's perspective and then a different person's perspective. So they're rather creative in finding ways of approaching the presentation of historiography, and they've all got their own themes. Now, this fits in with our discussion of rhythm, because as I was saying, when a passage becomes particularly important rhythmically, when it becomes particularly important thematically, it also becomes particularly dense rhythmically. In other words, you can sort of take a book of Appian, look at the passages where the rhythms come particularly thick and fast, and you'll find that most of those passages are either passages where he's sort of wanting to ratchet up the sort of emotion, and or they're passages which are particularly significant for his historical themes. And he's got two historical themes that he really wants to pursue. One is the idea of the Romans making war on each other. So they're the masters of the world, but they turn their weapons against each other. And this, they do so more and more as history goes on in the late Republic. So he's sort of chronicling this process of their increased violence against each other. And connected with that is his second theme, which is the rise of monarchy. And the Greeks don't have, the Romans are very sort of nervous about calling the setup with the emperor a monarchy, but the Greeks have no trouble about this at all. The emperors are kings, and it's a monarchia. Monarchia. And most of them think this is a good thing for various philosophical reasons as well as pleasing the emperors. So Appian is sort of tracing a paradoxical process. The Romans are getting more and more violent against each other, but it issues in something which he regards as satisfactory. And in particular, there are lots of ambiguities around the figure of Octavian, who, as you know, turns into Augustus. In the way that he's presented in Appian's narrative, he seems a terrifying figure, but he's also got something impressive and godlike about him. In item 18, he sort of comes on stage for the first time. And Caesar, this means Octavian, is talking to and Mark Antony, who's older than he is. A couple of heads of them there below. You can, not very nice pictures, but you can get an idea that that Octavian is a lot younger. But along comes this, and this is after the death of Julius Caesar. Mark Antony sees himself as the natural sort of successor to Caesar, but along comes this this awkward Octavian. I mean, he's awkward for Antony's purposes, and he makes a rather forthright speech to Antonius. And here is this passage, 18, which again I'll read in Greek. To iauta tu caesaros e pontos, ho Antonios kate plager, tes te paresias, kai tes eutolmias paradoxan hoi poles, kai parhelikian paneses. Calepsamenos de tois te logois, uchosone de to propenes auton eskercosi, kai malistoton crematon te apaitese, austeroteron auton hode e mepsato. And you notice there that in the first sentence, the first sentence, which is all about how amazed Antony is at Octavian, the rhythms are very tightly packed together, sort of almost an epiphany of this remarkable figure. But the next bit is much less noble. It's Antony is being a bit trivial and is annoyed he hasn't been respectful enough and he's asked for money, so he replies in a rather offhand way. So there the rhythms are much less tightly packed. So he's rather sort of expressive writing by Appian here. Here's another extract. Oh, and you notice, incidentally, that this sense of the impressiveness of Octavian comes through the eyes of the character Antony. It's not the narrator saying it so much, it's the character seeing it. It's quite an interesting way of handling it in terms of narrative. In item 19, we come up to a crucial moment in the sequence of Romans' violence against each other. This is the Battle of Pharsalus, where Julius Caesar defeats Pompey. And this is just before the battle. The others are keen that Pompey should fight Caesar, and he's not keen. Haper ho Pompeios, hoi apolemon emperos, apestrepeto, kaine meson e paotois, ene calypteto. I've put in bold these rhythmic endings that I forgot to mention. Catesio pad homos, hyp ognu caideus, hus per u strategon eti, alastrategumenos, kai panta prason, hupo ananches paragnomen, tos uton andri megalurgoi, kai parapan ergon, esecenenten hemeran, eutucestatoi genomenoi, to dystumon en epeptoce, ete hotita sumperonta crinon, uc epeten, al epic, cupon ecore pletus androntosonde soterias, caetes heautu doxes estote aetetu. Eteti caem anticotron auton plesias dontos edetu cacus sine tarasse, melontetes hemeras ecenes, ec dynasteas tos este, atros ec pesestae. So you can see there, it's leading up to a really critical moment, but it's seeing it through the eyes of Pompey and building up its significance in that way. And interesting there is the stance of the narrator. He doesn't see into the mind of Pompey, he just has to speculate about his motives. When he was talking about Antony just now, he's quite clear why Antony was being offhand with Octavian. But here he's, was it this, was it that? It creates an air of sort of mystery, which heightens the significance of the event. I think that, myself, that Pompey is here veiling himself, literally, because he doesn't want to have anything to do with these people. He wants to cut himself off from the events. If you look at this picture over the page, you can see that something a bit analogous in visual art. This is a painting from Pompeii that's now in the museum at Naples. Have some of you been to Pompeii? Excellent, good. Have you been to the museum in Naples as well? Great stuff. Right, well, this is a picture that's based originally on a 4th century Greek painter. Iphigenia is about to be sacrificed. And Agamemnon, well, actually she won't because there's Diana with the deer at the top of the page, but Agamemnon, her father, who's reluctantly agreed to this, is veiling his face. And in the ancient discussion of this picture, the thought is that his emotion is so intense that it couldn't be depicted by the painter. So it's more powerful not to show his face at all. But that's an interesting aesthetic approach, the idea that instead of sort of saying, he felt grief, distress, etc., etc., sort of just not saying something can be more powerful. In the same way, we've sort of got Pompey cutting himself off, veiling himself, but also at the same time, the narrator is sort of standing back from the events and just speculating on why he's behaving like this. Possibly he senses what's going to come, just possibly he doesn't know what's going to come, but he's worried about it. Possibly there's some sort of divine foreknowledge involved. But it all in heightens the significance and the mystery of this moment. So Appian, I think, emerges. Once you start reading him in this way, start looking quite closely at the style, you start to see the larger themes as well, and you see that he's actually a very powerful and a very careful writer. So what seems like sort of rather pointless combination Loctite fiddling is actually the way into thinking about his style and thinking about what he's aiming at as a writer and what themes he's highlighting and the whole structure of his work. It's sort of like a sort of tremendous cosmos with everything linked to everything else in item 17. I mentioned there a little parallel to the bit about Sulla and his prescriptions, which the editors of Appian, the commentators on Appian, haven't noticed. It's very, very close in language to what's said about the Eastern king Mithridates. Sulla picked up an idea from his enemy, and that's the point. Mithridates is an official enemy of the Romans, but Sulla is now turning this against his own people. So that's quite a neat, close correspondence, but people haven't noticed it because they haven't been reading Appian very carefully, which this rhythm approach enables us to do. I want to turn now, quite quickly, to a writer who's had a much better press and who also writes rhythmically. This is Plutarch. Here, the interest is not so much in proving that Plutarch is a careful writer. Surprisingly, although a massive amount of work has been done on Plutarch recently, very little has been done on his style. But I think that it's more important to show how his rhythmic practice relates to his themes. He writes these parallel lives. Most of the biographies by Plutarch that we have fit into this sequence of parallel lives between Greeks and Romans. And probably he certainly issued them in numbered books, so they form a sequence. We don't know what the numbers are in most cases, and we don't know what the original sequence was, but it's clear they're meant to be a structure. So it's a very, very complicated thing that he's got here. You've got Greek against Roman in each of two pairs. Each life is also a structure on its own, and he's building up larger themes about Greek and Roman history and about the nature of history generally. So it's a very, very complicated structure, a bit like Ovid's Metamorphoses, if you know that, where you have lots of individual stories, but they relate to each other in complicated ways. Probably Plutarch is more coherent philosophically than Ovid is. Ovid is a bit of a sort of, he mucks about. My sister was a teacher at a primary school for quite a long while, and one day she found that somebody had written his name on somebody else's flip-flops, and she called this person up and said to him in a stern voice, trying not to laugh, let's call him Darren, why did you write your name on these flip-flops? And Darren replied, for a muckabout. So this phrase, for a muckabout, sticks in my mind. Anyway, Ovid mucks about, but Plutarch is a serious philosopher and writes lots of philosophical works as well as these lives. And the lives and the philosophical works are all written rhythmically. His rhythms are less dense, occur less frequently on the whole than in Appian, and less frequently in the philosophical works than in the lives. But nonetheless, it can still be shown, I haven't set out the proof here, it can still be shown that he's definitely a rhythmic writer. Let's take a couple of passages which are climactic in Plutarch. The first is from his life of Timoleon, near the end of that. Timoleon came from Corinth and sorted things out in Sicily in the 4th century. And this is a sort of passage which sums up what Timoleon did and tries to show what a sort of positive approach to people Timoleon had. Tasmenon tyrannidas ho Timoleon touton ton tropon exekopse caetus polemus eluse tend holen neson ex egriomenen hypokakon kai diem emisemenen hypoton oiketoron paralabon hutos exemerose kai potenen epoies epasin hoste plen oikeasontas heterus hoten hoipolitae proteron apedidraskon. Hois umonon aspaleian ec polemu tosutu kai galenem hidruomenois paraskon alla caeta la parasceo asas kai sum protunetes hosper oikistes egapato caeton allonde die cecemenon homoios hapanton pros auton, u polemu tis lusis, u nomon tesis, u coras catoicismos, u politeas diataxis, ed oce calos ecen, hes ecenos me pros apsaito. Mede catacos meseien hosper ergois sunte lumenoi demiurgos, epitites tinacarin teopilea cae prepusan. So you can see there the bit at the end, you notice that with all those repeated negatives, no ending of the war, no giving of laws, no colonization, it's really heaping it up rhetorically. So it's not just a quick summary, it's sort of really giving you an idea of the immensity of his achievement. Very interesting at the end is the comparison of him to an artist. And in the bit that follows this, he says there's something about Timoleon's deeds, they were just sort of naturally right and attractive. There were other great people who did things, but their deeds were a bit sort of rough. He's more like Homer, whose writing is just sort of easy and flowing. The good deeds just sort of naturally came like that. So he's sort of making an interesting link between moral and aesthetic qualities. And he's doing so in a passage that's very sort of aesthetically refined and beautifully crafted itself. Here's another passage, number 24. And this is about Numa, the early king of Rome. Remember, Romulus, the first king, was rather sort of warlike and did lots of aggressive conquering and so forth. Numa was more peaceful, sorted out Rome's religion with a view to keeping everyone orderly. Anyway, here is Plutarch on Numa. Ugar monon hor Romaion hemeroto kai katekeleto te idikai osunete kai praoteti tu basileos demos alla kai tas kykloi poles hosper auras tinos eketen epneumatos hygienu perontos arche metaboles elabe kai potos is erue pantas eu nomeas kai eirenes kai gen puteuen, kai tecna trepen en her sukiae, kai sebestai teus, heortai de kai taliae, kai par allelos adios ionton, kai anamnigmenon hypotokai kai pyloprosunai ten italian katekon hoion ek peges tes nomas sopias ton kalon kai dikaion ep es reonton es hapantas kai die ke iomenes tes peri ekenon galenes. And if you've read some, if you can remember some Greek and Roman history, you can see how unlike historiographical writing that is. It's got a kind of lyricism about it. These metaphors, images of beautiful natural things like breezes and, well, they're beautiful things if you're in a hot climate, and flowing water and so forth. It's a very sort of lyrical, almost poetic passage. And if you're trying to find analogies to the language, you can find it really in things like the end of Aeschylus's Oresteia or Horace's Carmen Saeculare and so on, some items there under 25. Indeed, at the, just after this passage, he says, Numa's deeds, you know, sort of surpassed all the exaggerations of poetry. So you can see in a way that this prose, this historiography, sort of historiographical prose, is actually surpassing poetry as well. So a key word there is praotes, gentleness, in the second line of the passage. This is a key quality for Plutarch. Although his lives are all about these sort of generals and military rulers and warlords and so on, actually a quality that he's really keen on is gentleness. And this fits in, it all fits in with his sort of philosophy and his approach to life. So you can get an idea how these very intensely rhythmic passages highlight themes that Plutarch really wants to bring out. So again, you can see the value of looking at rhythm. I'll just talk very briefly now about the sort of overall literary landscape in the imperial period. As I say, we don't yet know all that much about it. But one could use some of these figures to have a kind of approximate guess. I'll go through this fairly quickly, just not getting into too much mathematical detail. But if you've got a random distribution, say if you were to take a load of people in the street and just sort of measure how high, how tall they were, and not choose a group of policemen or whatever, then you could sort of, you've got to get a random distribution. And curiously enough, you could find a sort of mean, get an average height, and then the differences of individuals from that height wouldn't be that, on the whole, they wouldn't be that great. Or at least you could sort of measure the amount by which they would be likely to be different from the average. And if they were vastly above the average, then that would be a bit suspicious, or vastly below the average. There'd be something special going on. All this was worked out by a great German mathematician in the 18th century, Gauss. Anyway, one can do things like that. You could take the set of 400 random sentences that we got, break them up a bit, and see if it forms a kind of random distribution. Does it follow this sort of Gaussian curve? And roughly speaking, it does. So it looks like a sort of random distribution. So once you can do that, you could then take samples from writers in the Roman Empire, Greek writers in the Roman Empire, and see, do they differ a lot from the sort of mean, the average that you get of these pre-rhythmic writers? And if they differ a lot, then that suggests that there's rhythmic writing going on, because it's not random. And whereas with the, if you can look back at item 15, you can see that of 20, out of 20 sentences each, the numbers we're getting are 13, 14, 11, 12, that kind of thing. That gives you an idea of the kind of deviation to expect. But with these imperial writers, you can take a lot of samples, under 27, all these examples I tried, and we get quite a lot of imperial writers who come out with 16, 17, 18, 19. So that does strongly suggest, although it's only a sort of, we're not certain it's a random distribution with, in the technical sense, with the with the pre-rhythmic writers, and it's only a very, very small sample. So it's just giving, it's not proving anything, it's just giving us a rough idea. But it does look as though we've got quite a lot of rhythmic writing going on in the imperial period. I've recently done some more elaborate figures which broadly confirm this, though not in each case. And it's notable if you look at which figures really stand out. Which genres really stand out. It's not something terribly neat, as with the Roman case, where it's just historians and technical writers who don't. That's a nice, neat pattern. Here it's less neat. But the genres which keep coming up are not oratory, as you might expect, but historiography and novels. In other words, narrative. People like using it to heighten their narratives and bring out their themes and so forth. There are exceptions, including Heliodorus, who's the latest of the novelists, so is perhaps writing after this rhythmic way of writing goes out of fashion, and we can tell a point at which it does. And Arrian, who is mad keen on Xenophon, and actually calls himself Xenophon, and wants to be a sort of Xenophon reincarnate. Xenophon is writing before this rhythmic sort of writing, so his writing is not rhythmic, even though he's writing about Alexander, writing about the same subject that Hegesias had written about in his history. He wants to do it non-rhythmically. So this just to give one a very, very rough impression, but it does look as though there's quite a lot of rhythmic writing going on in the imperial period, beside the cases of Appian and Plutarch, which we've scrutinised in more detail. I've scanned all of Plutarch's Lives and Morale, which is quite a lot of Teubner pages. But besides those cases, we can see that there's a lot of rhythmic writing going on. Anyway, the larger point to make is that this sort of close reading of prose, really close, careful analysis of it, has a lot of dividends to pay. People often sort of scrutinise poetry very closely, but with prose, they're not so bothered. But actually, these writers themselves were very interested in the detail of how they wrote. They thought this was very important. And once we start looking closely at the detail of the writers, we start to form a different impression of them, not only of their style, which you would expect, but also of their larger themes and the whole ways in which they organise and construct their works. So, although I wouldn't say that poetry and prose are the same thing, it's worth reading and analysing prose just as carefully as we do poetry. So that was my little chat.
Thank you.
Thank you.